Welcome to Before They Were Live, an ongoing, monthly, and extremely nerdy conversation through the land of fairy, or the perilous realm. In his seminal essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien says he has, quote, hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder, but not of information. We take the same tack. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in a healthy ecosystem of art and criticism and fandom, trying to pay attention to the ways stories have shaped our collective imaginations. We are also slurpers of soup, happy to ladle out a bowlful from the great cauldron of story that has been bubbling and brewing for centuries. W.H. Auden said, quote, art is our chief means of breaking bread with the dead. So please pull up a chair to our table, grab yourselves a soup bowl, a big old chunk of homemade bread. Help us enrich this reading experience and have some fun too. Today we have two very old tales for you, set in the world of Harun al-Rashid, the Caliph of Baghdad in the late 8th century, told in the Arabian Nights. These are told from nights 34 to 45, but we will tell them much faster than Shahrazad because our life does not depend on the story continuing, thankfully. So then, merchants, men of wealth, podcast connoisseurs, not everything round is a walnut. Not everything long is a banana. Not everything red is meat. Not everything that's white is fate is fat. But here with me to tell this story is a unique pearl beyond all price, the one and only Michael Farmer.
How's it going, Josh?
Oh, it's good to be back with you again on the podcast. And I say this meaningfully, it is good to be back in the Arabian Nights. This is the third one that we've done. The first two I did not enjoy, and I was wondering what in the world we had gotten ourselves into. But these two tales tonight, I enjoyed both of them. So
they're much, in my opinion, these two are much closer to fairy tales in terms of their structure than the other ones we've been talking about have been.
Absolutely.
They both have that you catastrophe that Tolkien talks about in On Fairy Stories. And while they are still definitely in the Arabian Nights, they have the kind of sexuality that is typical of the Arabian Nights, they do feel more like the Grimms to me.
The PG-13-ness of it, or even beyond PG-13, is really like amusing to me now, I guess. Like, it took me a little while to get used to it, but now I don't know, maybe I've become a wickeder person or something, but I've been more immunized. What's the word? That's not it.
Immunized,
But anyway, yes. But it's funny. It's as you say that, like, there is. I actually, as I was reading through and annotating these things, it's really amazing to me that they also are there. There's like these little moments of worship, or bursts of praise all throughout. So, like, for example, the place where I put the note in our first story that you're going to tell us in a minute, it says, this is on page 260 for anybody following along. They did this, and then they washed their faces and their hands, after which, as the breeze fanned them, they fell asleep. Glory be to him who does not sleep.
Yeah.
Like, and there's little moments like that all throughout stories, like, where they just, you know, throw in a little burst of praise to Allah, I guess. But yeah, a creator God, a God that sustains, a God that doesn't sleep. I mean, there are many things that as Christians we can agree with, you know, attributes of God that we can agree with. And it's just funny, the juxtaposition of those two things, I guess, culturally. why they're odd to me, and probably definitely not odd to the original hearers.
Yeah, and Harun al-Rashid is the caliph during the Abbasid caliphate, I believe. And it's a time of general secularization in the Muslim world. This is the beginning of the Islamic Golden Age. So they're still very Muslim, but at the same time you get a kind of loosening of some of the more staunch moral rules that you had seen under the first four, I think, caliphates, the first four caliphates and Muhammad before that. And so it is interesting, right, that they're doing all sorts of things that you would not assume that faithful Muslims would do. But at the same time, they're definitely Muslim. And the stories are pious in their own way, especially the first one here, which I think in some ways is, I hesitate to use the word straightforward because nothing in the Arabian Nights is straightforward, but a straightforward celebration of divine providence, right? I mean, this is a story about divine providence in some ways.
Oh yeah, absolutely. not to spoil it, but it's very explicitly the moral at the end of the story, which I love.
Yeah.
So when we get there, we can talk about it. But yeah.
So yeah, right. That kind of non straightforward soup, to use your metaphor from the beginning, this stew into which all of these elements are thrown. That's the great pleasure to me of the Arabian Nights, is everything is in them. And you never quite know what you're going to get from any particular story. That first story did not go at all the direction I thought it was going to go.
This one that you're about to tell, you mean?
Yeah, that's right. It just, like, I don't know what I expected. I did not expect it to end where it ended.
Yeah, it's yeah, we should get into it. But before we do, the other thing too, for intrepid listeners to be paying attention to, is exactly what we were just talking about, Michael. There, even within this story, you can see that loosening up of kind of the moral rigidity. There's a point in the story, and if you don't highlight it in your telling, we can come back to it, of course. But like where the caliph himself is going to be very angry about some immorality, but then very quickly his heart will soften on it. So,
yeah, Harun al-Rashid is such an interesting character. These are the second and the third, I think, that he's shown up in. He's also in he's in the Three Ladies of Baghdad, the porter in the Three Ladies of Baghdad, which I don't think we talked about because it's filthy.
Yeah, I don't. It's been so long.
Yeah, it has. This might be the third and the fourth. He's shown up before, and he's always an interesting figure, because they kind of have a good time with him, but then also he's always a figure for justice at the end of the story. He's not evil. He's not the king that Scheherazade is talking to.
Oh yeah, definitely not.
But also, you kind of feel bad for his vizier, Jafar.
Oh yeah, because he's constantly being threatened with death.
Yeah, anytime something goes wrong, the caliph is like, Jafar, if you don't make this right, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah, and your family.
Makes you wonder why he didn't just leave Baghdad and go somewhere else.
Yeah.
Anytime you saw the vizier Jafar, did you picture Jafar from Aladdin?
I couldn't help it. And actually, in this first story, so it's funny because, so the bad guy in this first story that you're about to tell is Al-Mu'in. Is that, I don't know if that's right pronunciation, but I kept inadvertently writing Jafar in my notes when I meant to write Al-Mu'in, even though, because he's the bad guy, you know? So, yeah.
That's funny.
I keep correcting it.
Well, I'll tell the first story here. It's called Nur al-Din Ali and Anis al-Jalis. That's what we're calling it anyway. There's multiple names that these stories get because they're not directly named in the text. Once a king had two viziers, one of them good and one of them was evil. The evil one was not named Jafar. The king wanted to get married, and so he asked the good vizier to find him a bride. And so the good vizier finds him this beautiful slave girl named Anis al-Jalis. But before he can bring her to the king, the vizier's own son, Nur al-Din Ali, seduced her, and they fell hopelessly in love with each other. The good vizier was really worried that the evil vizier would use this event to make life difficult for him, but that doesn't happen. The king just forgets about this girl, and the two lovers live happily for a little while. And then the good vizier died, and Nur al-Din Ali became very rich from his inheritance, and he just starts throwing his money around, living beyond his means. He thinks he has all of these friends, but then he runs out of money, and he has no one left in the world other than Anis al-Jalis. And in order to stay alive, he tries to sell her into slavery. The evil vizier bids on her, but then Nur al-Din is informed by his faithful steward that the evil vizier is not going to pay for her, even if he wins her. And so Nur al-Din refuses to sell her to him. And so the evil vizier goes to the king and tells him a version of the story that suggests that Nur al-Din is the actual villain. And so Nur al-Din and Anis al-Jalis flee to Baghdad, and the king ends up offering a reward to anyone who can bring them back to him, presumably so he can execute them. Well, as soon as they get to Baghdad, they end up immediately in Caliph Harun al-Rashid's magnificent gardens. And there's an old man, like a caretaker of the gardens. His name is Ibrahim. And he finds them, and he wants to be hospitable, so he feeds them. And they trick him into drinking wine, which he hasn't done in more than a decade. And the three of them get incredibly drunk and have a big party right in the middle of the night. Well, meanwhile, the caliph is in his palace, and he looks out and sees that the lights in the garden are on, and he's very interested in what's happening. So he and his vizier, Jafar, go to investigate, and they hear Anis al-Jalis singing a beautiful song, and the caliph wants to meet her. So he goes to a fisherman and orders him to give him his clothes and some fish, and he disguises himself to go sell this fish so he can meet these visitors. And once again, he hears Anis al-Jalis sing, and he falls in love with her. So Nur al-Din offers to give her to the caliph and tells the caliph what had happened to them. And the caliph, never revealing his true identity, they still think he's a fisherman, he offered to write a letter to the king on their behalf. And Nur al-Din goes back to his hometown to deliver it to him. And Anis al-Jalis stays in Baghdad until the time is right. So when he gets back home, Nur al-Din gives the letter to the king. And the king agrees to do what it says, which is to step down and allow Nur al-Din to be the king. But just as that's about to happen, the evil vizier convinces him that the letter's a forgery, and so Nur al-Din is sentenced to death. And just as they're about to cut his head off, the caliph arrives with Jafar. Nur al-Din is released. The evil vizier is executed instead. I guess once you get the execution set up, they've got to execute somebody. And the caliph gives Nur al-Din back to Jafar. The caliph gives Anis al-Jalis back to Nur al-Din, and they lived happily ever after.
It's a very fun story. You did a great job telling it, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you. What did I hit the part you wanted to make sure we hit? You're talking about the three of them getting drunk in the garden, I assume.
Yeah, so they're drunk. Yeah, they're drunk in the garden, and this part of the story is actually really funny to me because so you've got the caliph and Jafar there, and the caliph, you know, he climbs up in the tree, so that's funny in itself, just that he's climbing a tree, I think, and he peeks in there and he sees what they're doing, and he comes down and he says something really sarcastic to Jafar, like we're surrounded by such you know, pious people or something. I don't remember exactly what he says, you know, but he's angry. Like, he's really angry. And Jafar knows, like, he's in for it because he kind of earlier stuck his neck out for Ibrahim when the, you know, when he's first asked about, you know, why are the lights on in the, in like, why is there this party happening over there?
Oh, that's right. He tells a lie about it, right? He makes up a story.
Yeah, he's kind of like, oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you. He's, you know, his sons are being circumcised or something. I don't know. And so, yeah. Anyway,
my favorite interaction between the caliph and Jafar in this story is they're waiting to hear the girl sing. It says, the caliph says, "By God, if this girl sings badly, I will crucify you all. And if she sings well, I will only crucify you." "May God make her sing badly," exclaimed Jafar. "Why?" asked the caliph. "So that if you crucify us all, we can keep each other company," Jafar replied, at which the caliph laughed. He must just be used to the caliph threatening to kill him at every moment.
Yeah, and he can just make light of it like that. And actually, the caliph also, like, he laughs there, and he laughs several times through the story. You actually have a really, like he's not the sultan in Aladdin. Like, he's not a doofus, you know? But he just seems like a really, like, you know, jovial fellow. Actually, another part I love in this story is after he has disguised himself as the fisherman, Jafar at first does not know that he's done this, and he comes up to Jafar as the fisherman, and Jafar's like, "Dude, you're in the wrong place right now. Like, the caliph is in the garden. If he sees you in his garden, he's going to kill you," you know? And the caliph laughs at this, at Jafar trying to protect this fisherman. And Jafar recognizes him by his laugh. That's what it says in the story, which I think is lovely. You know, to be recognized by a laugh.
Yeah, the caliph makes a lot of threats, but so far, at least in the 300 pages or whatever we've read, I don't think we've seen him execute anybody who didn't deserve it by the lights of the story. Like he is a force for justice. It's just when he enters the story, he's almost always a threat.
Yeah, and people are afraid of him for sure. You know, and rightfully so, I guess. If he can order your death, you know. Yeah, I thought there is an execution in this story. And I thought it was that I also thought that part was really interesting because the caliph tells Nur al-Din, like, you can kill him, and has him take his sword so he can kill him. And al-Mu'in, the evil vizier, he says, I acted as my nature and you must act as yours. And when Nur al-Din hears that, he throws down his sword because he's like, such a generous person that he can't even take this person, even though all the evil that's been done to him, he can't take his life. So then the guard does it anyway. So, I mean, he still loses his life, but Nur al-Din doesn't have the blood on his hands.
Nur al-Din is such an interesting character because when he appears at the beginning of the story and seduces Anis al-Jalis, you think he's going to be a villain. And he's not. Like, he's the hero of the story, and he's fairly uncomplicated as the hero. He has faults, but he's generally attempting to do the right thing, even after he seduces her. And she's not the first girl he's seduced, right? The reason she's interested in him is that all the other women in town are talking about how handsome he is and presumably how good he is in bed. And so she kind of allows herself to be seduced. She wants to be seduced, so she seeks him out, I guess is the way I would put it.
Yeah, that's right. She knows very well that she is intended for the Sultan, but she also lies about it and says, "Oh, this guy came in and he, you know, he said I was the one that the vizier bought me for, and I believed him," even though she knows the opposite is true. So,
yeah. Yeah, so there's this sense that she is not a she's not a pawn in this story, right? She has some agency.
Yeah, she has quite a bit of agency. She actually Nur al-Din is really interesting as a character because, like you said, he has his faults, and the story definitely seems. I feel like the story is ambiguous, just ambiguous enough about his faults, because what he is, his fault. Is that he is wildly generous, like unreasonably generous.
Right.
Gives away all of his stuff, but always in the belief that generosity pays off in the end. Like the person who is generous will be repaid in the end, you know? And so he has this trust in, I don't know, fate or God. I'm not sure, you know, like it's not clear in the story what his trust is in. But he does have this trust in, like, I'm behaving honorably, and so the honorable thing will eventually happen to me. But throughout the story, then, the person with kind of the head on her shoulders, because he is so ridiculously, like, just, like, you know, if somebody says they like something, he just gives it to them.
Including his wife.
Including his wife, yes. That's what I was just getting to. Yeah, that's Anis al-Jalis, you know, she's the one who kind of, you know, helps him to recognize his situation and know the right thing to do. And even when he does give her away to the fisherman or the, you know, the caliph dressed as the fisherman, he doesn't know it's the caliph. She's brokenhearted, you know, she's like, what are you doing? Like, how could you give me away at this moment? And his response to that. I found it really ambiguous too, because he said, like, it's in poetry, first of all, but I think you can interpret it two ways because, let me just flip to it here. He says, the pangs of longing made her weep and say, what will you find to do when I have gone? I said, say this to one who stays alive. And so, I think you can read it two ways. Like either he's going to die of a broken heart by giving her away, or he knows that, like, in his stage in life right now, he's got 40 of the coins in his pocket and he's already spent, I guess, probably close to half of them. And that's all he has. Like that's everything he has. So maybe he's thinking, you know, I'm going to die of starvation. It's better that you, you know, at least get married to this fisherman who can provide for you, you know, has some sort of job,
Right, yeah,
because I have nothing.
that's a charitable move. And correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't she, when he's going to sell her back into slavery, doesn't she suggest that? Isn't that her idea at the beginning?
Yeah, that is her idea. And
So
she
you get
doesn't
that
want, I mean, she
parallel,
doesn't.
right? That
Yeah. And
she has offered to sacrifice herself for him while they're still in the hometown. And then at Basra, I think it's Basra. And then he offers to sacrifice himself for her by giving her to the fishermen and starving to death once they're in Baghdad.
yeah. Yeah. So it's there's definitely some dark moments in this thing where it's like, oh man, this is not really like you said, it doesn't turn the way you think it's going to turn. And thankfully it doesn't, you know, like thankfully in neither case do they actually have to be parted. But
Yeah,
yeah.
at no point does it do, except until the very end, at no point does it do what you think it's going to do. Because when they get Ibrahim drunk, you think they're doing a bad thing and they're going to be punished for it, but it's just another of the story's little jokes that this kind of uptight caretaker ends up getting absolutely plastered there in the garden. And he does it because, how does she put it? She tells him her story. And he's moved by it because of course it's a sad story. She filled a glass and looking at him, she said, "By my life, please take this and drink it. Don't reject it, but mend my broken heart." And that's how he drinks the first glass of wine, and after that he can't
Right.
stop, which is dark
Yeah.
if you try to treat it realistically. But of course it's not treated realistically, and this is Ibrahim's entrance into this world of joy that's taking place in this garden overnight. That they are able to let loose. They're able to share their, the three of them are able to share their lives with each other and eventually with the caliph as well.
Yeah, I think that's really a good way to say it. Like, there is an entrance into a joy, which he's living in a garden of delights. You know, like it's like described in a very like Eden-esque type way. You know, this garden, and but he, in the beginning, you know, he wants to chase them off originally. Like, no one should be enjoying this garden, and he himself is withholding from pleasure as well. And so, yeah, I think there is something in this story between his between Nur al-Din, our hero's like outrageous generosity, and then the caliph lightening up and Iribim lightening up. There is something in this story about like, hey, don't hold on to things so tightly. Like, enjoy them, you know. And so, yeah, I think there that's a good. A good message, I think.
Yeah, and gardens are, if anything, even more important in Islam than they are in Judaism and Christianity, because it's not just the Garden of Eden, but in the Quran, almost any time it refers to heaven, it describes it as a garden in sometimes great detail. Like what is the garden going to be like? What kind of trees are going to be in it? What are the paths going to look like? So in general, when you see gardens in the Arabian Nights, I think you're probably meant to think of heaven. And I like that observation that Ibrahim is living here in heaven and has no means of enjoying it until this couple comes along that allows him to enjoy it in a semi-licit matter.
Yeah. Semi-lesson. The other thing I noticed in here that I thought was interesting is there's a forgetfulness that is good. Like it is Al-Mu'in, the evil vizier who never forgets and is always like looking for his moment of vengeance. But both the Sultan forgets, and it says that God caused him to forget. Like, God causes the Sultan to forget that he had asked Nur al-Din's father for a beautiful slave, sex slave girl, you know.
Yeah,
He forgets
another thing
about
you probably don't want to think too much about is the fact that this woman is a sex slave.
it. Right. But yeah, I shouldn't laugh about it, I'm sorry. But the text is explicit that God causes him to forget, and that's how Nur al-Din's dad never gets in trouble over the fact that Nur al-Din seduces her and takes her for himself. And then later in the story, after this crazy, you know, rendezvous in the garden and the party, and the caliph writes this letter, and then takes her home with him, not to have her as his own, but just to, just have her have a place to stay until Nur al-Din becomes the sultan. And then he just totally forgets about her. Like he comes, like it's like when he runs into her again and hears her crying, he comes in, he's like, "Who are you? What are you, why are you in my palace crying?" And she's like, "Don't you remember? Like, we had this whole thing and you sent my husband away." So it's just, I don't know. But the timing works out perfectly, So there's almost, it seems like it's almost a providential sort of forgetfulness that he forgot about her, because it allows them to catch the evil vizier in the act of getting ready to execute Nur al-Din. And if Jafar had arrived sooner or something, maybe they wouldn't have been able to, maybe things wouldn't have worked out as well. So there seems to be a heavenly sort of forgetting,
Right.
which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, and when you think about the way forgiveness is described in the Book of Psalms as the sea of forgetfulness, that God forgets our sins.
Yeah, I think that's really, that's really good.
Yeah, I this
So.
has been my favorite of the Arabian Nights stories so far. I really like every single piece of it.
Yeah, I agree. This one was, this one was also my favorite. The next one is also good, but this one was my favorite. There's a lot of poetry in this one, which I love. I just think it's so fun. So there, the one moment, there's not much to say about it except that when Nur al-Din is going to have to run for his life, and but he's warned before he has to run. He says, "Master, this is not a time for greetings or for words. Listen to what the poet said." So, and then he recites a poem. So I wrote down that it's not time for greetings, but there is always time for poetry.
As I recall,
But
that's
then,
your favorite thing about the Arabian Nights is how ready everybody always is to break out into poetry.
constantly, yes. So then, when they're with the caliph, who is disguised as a fisherman, and he wants to hear their story, he asks Nur al-Din, or I'm sorry, Nur al-Din is going to recite it, but he says, "Do you want it in prose or poetry?" And the caliph answers, "Prose is only speech, but poetry is strung pearls." And then at that, Nur al-Din looked down and at the ground and recited, and he retells the story that you've been reading, which I said is a bit like when C-3PO recalls their whole story to the Ewoks. In Return of the Jedi, you kind of get the story within the story.
It sounds like a lovely society to live in. I suspect the actual Abbasid Caliphate was not quite this magical, but this land where there's all these gardens and you have a semi-friendly caliph and everybody's always speaking in poetry, everybody's ready to recite dozens of lines of poetry at any particular moment.
Yeah. And the caliph knows the fisherman by name. Like, so even like there's like kind of a small town feel to it too, Like, oh yeah, like even though like I'm at the highest level and you're at the lowest level, like I know your name and we can joke with each other because when the caliph puts on the robes of the fisherman, there's lice all in it, And the fisherman's like, "Oh, you'll get used to it." And I can teach you to fish if you want a real job, like
I wonder, and
very
of
funny.
course,
It's
you and I
very
do
funny.
no research whatsoever before these shows, but I wonder if these stories were
We are
written.
trespassers only,
That's
Michael.
right. That's a nice line to keep us from having to do any real work. I wonder if these stories were written during the time of Harun al-Rashid, and they're there to kind of flatter him a little bit, or whether they were written later and he's just a legendarily good caliph, and so his name gets attached to these. And probably
Yeah.
there's no way to answer that question if I had to guess, because I don't think we have
Yeah.
dates for any particular story in the Arabian Nights, but
Yeah,
I,
there
I
could be a little of both, you know, like it could have been like there were stories told at the time with him in it, and then because he became kind of a character in them, then afterwards he continued to be, you know, so it could be a bit of each.
Yeah, that makes sense. But yeah, he is his repeated presence in these stories is delightful, and I'm always excited to see him.
Yeah, he's a fun character. I'm gonna have to go back and see which other one he was in because I don't think I noticed him the first time. Actually, I remember in the episode you mentioned he was a real person. I
Yeah,
was like,
because
oh,
we talked about
I
him a
didn't
little
know.
bit.
And then yeah, and then later I realized that I have a glossary at the end of my book and I can look up names and find out. And I didn't know that at the time, so.
I know he's in The Porter and the Three Ladies of Baghdad because
Okay.
he shows up and it keeps the story from when we didn't talk about this one because it's so explicit, but it keeps what's happening in that story from becoming just a pornographic film, basically when he shows up.
Yeah.
But I don't remember if he's in any others or if it's just that one. He must be in another one, or else we wouldn't have talked about him. Since we didn't talk
Yeah.
about the Three Ladies of Baghdad. You know, I was hoping when we started reading these, I have a paper in my 10th grade class where they have to use five sources from before 1800 and they're having to define a word. And I thought, oh, it'll be great to read these because I can send some of the students to the Arabian Nights and they can use some of these stories. No. No, I
You
cannot.
could maybe send them to that one that we just told. You could not send them to this next one that we're about to tell,
No,
but
but
you could
even the
maybe
one
send
we
them to
just told, it's fairly, I don't know. I'm always worried about sending them to anything even kind of explicit. And I mean, it is like the story definitely describes Nur al-Din and Anis al-Jalis having sex for the first time.
Sure. Yeah.
It's not as bad as The Three Ladies of Baghdad. And like you say, it's not as bad
Oh,
as
yeah, no.
Ibn Ayyub. But
Well, it's not even as bad as some Shakespeare, I would say, maybe.
huh.
This particular story.
Well, so
I mean, my,
the thing
so
about
my, I say that, be, go ahead.
the content, you were correct, is not as bad, but Shakespeare, it does not immediately read as filthy because he doesn't use, like, this uses anatomical words in a way that Shakespeare would not. So Shakespeare makes a lot of dirty jokes, but at no point does he refer to anybody's genitals. In scientific language, right? Shakespeare doesn't say penis,
Right.
whereas as the Arabian Nights definitely do.
Yeah, that's true. My daughter is in 9th grade, so she is reading Romeo and Juliet, and the school here has the No Fear Shakespeare.
Oh man.
I don't know if you're familiar with those.
Oh yeah, I'm familiar.
I don't love it, but I kind of understand it. I mean, 90% of our school is second language learners,
Yeah,
so
Shakespeare would be really hard if you didn't already speak
Shakespeare's
English.
hard for first language speakers, you know. So I get it. But yeah, reading it in the updated language, it's pretty explicit in places. So
Oh
she's like,
yeah, I mean
why do we have
Shakespeare
to,
is
why do
filled to the brim with dirty jokes.
Yeah, and I think I didn't know because I was reading it in Shakespearean language and missing a lot of it, you know, because we did not have No Fear Shakespeare. So it wasn't until I was older that I knew that, you know. As far as I remember, did not know that as a 9th grader, but
No, they didn't cover that in 9th grade when I read Romeo and Juliet. Although the thing that blows my mind now that I teach high school is when I was in 9th grade, they showed us the Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet, which has nudity.
yeah,
I cannot imagine showing one of my classes a film with
they
nudity in it.
must. Did they show the nudity or did they skip past
Oh no,
it?
they showed it.
Wow,
They definitely showed
Georgia.
it. I remember it very well.
Not so in Nebraska.
Oh,
We
they just
because we
fast-forwarded past that.
I think we watched parts of it. I don't think we watched the whole thing all the way through. I think we
Olivia
watched
Hussey's
parts.
the
I
most
don't
beautiful woman in the world in that movie.
know. My 9th grade self might agree with you. I can't even picture her in my mind right now, so.
Make sure you have safe search on if you Google her name with Romeo and Juliet.
Okay.
We've gone a little far afield, but that's okay. Do you want to tell us the story of Ghanim ibn Ayyub? I'm glad you're doing it because I clearly cannot pronounce his name.
Oh yeah, I can't.
We should
I
apologize
just.
to our listeners for the fact that I'm sure our Arabic pronunciations are just awful.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. That's our, I mean, my English pronunciation's not good. So, so many apologies on multiple levels. Okay, this is the slave of love, is what I'll call it. I can pronounce all of those words. They're all single syllables. So a merchant has a son, and his name is Ghanim, and he is the slave of love. And he has a sister as well. That's going to be important later. And his father dies, leaves him great wealth. His father was a merchant, and his father actually had some merchandise that he wanted sold in Baghdad. And so Ghanim takes that merchandise that his father intended to sell and heads over to Baghdad. And he gets there and he's having a really good time as a merchant. And he's selling these things off little by little. It takes about a year. And one day he goes to work and everything's closed down. And he says, "Hey, what's going on? How come the whole marketplace is shut down?" And they said, "Oh, one of the merchants has died, but you can earn heavenly awards going to his funeral." And he says, "Yeah, I should do that then." So he joined, even though he does not know this particular merchant, he joins the funeral train and the wailers and whatnot, and they all head out towards the tombs and the burial grounds. After they get out there, he starts feeling really awkward and shy because he doesn't know these people, and he's and we've all been in the situation where you're not sure when is the appropriate time to leave. Well, he misses the appropriate time to leave, and so he's staying way late, and he starts worrying about the fact that he's a visitor in the city. He's known to be wealthy, and so his house could very easily be being robbed right now while he's out mourning for this guy that he doesn't even actually mourn for. And so he decides, okay, I gotta go back. I gotta go. So he excuses himself and starts heading back towards the city. Unfortunately, by the time he gets to the city, the gates are already closed for the night. The guards are sleeping. He can't get in, and so he heads back out to the tombs. He's going to hide and there for the evening. Well, the tomb that he decides to hide at, three men soon show up, and they've got a chest with them, and they dig a hole in the ground, they bury the chest, and then they leave. And so he's obviously very curious about this, so he digs up the chest. He opens it, and inside is a girl, and she has been drugged. And so he takes her out, and she revives. And she's very beautiful. He immediately falls in love with her. She is confused about where she is, and she says, "You know, last I knew, I was in a harem, and now here I am." And but she doesn't say whose harem or anything like that. She just like calls out to some of the people. And so he says, "Hey, I rescued you from this situation." And so she thanks him, and she says, "Here's what you should do. You should put me back in this box, and then hire a mule and take me back into the city and take me to your house and but hide me there in your house, because obviously people are out to kill me." So he does that, and he takes her, and when they get back to his house, she's beautiful and he's beautiful, and he's wealthy and she's wealthy, and they're just equally yoked, you could say. And so they both fall madly in love with one another. They're both very interested in each other, but she is not like, she's like, "I have a story, and I cannot tell you my story, but there's a reason why we cannot have a physical union." But he wants it bad. And so they're spending a lot of time together, and they even sleep in the same bed, it seems, in the story. But nothing is happening. But he's definitely wanting things to happen. So eventually, after about a month of this, which that's amazing to me that this goes on for a month. after a month of this, she finally says, "Hey, I'm actually a concubine in the caliph's harem, and so I've been promised for him, and no one can touch me except for him." Well, this works. He's like, "Oh, that's okay." And he backs way off. He gets a second bed. They start sleeping in two beds. But his honorableness in this matter, and his, I guess, chastity, you would call it, or his abstinence or whatever, is extremely attractive to her. And so now she's like, actually, forget the caliph. And so she's like going after him. And so there's this real like tension and angst in the story where, you know, at first he wanted her and she kept refusing. And now, even though she did want him, but like now she really wants him and he still wants her, but now he's the one refusing. Anyway, in the meantime, the caliph returns back to his palace. And when he gets there, the woman who thinks that she has had our heroine's name, I didn't name her, is because I don't know how to pronounce this. It's Kut
Kut
al
Kulub is how I pronounce it.
Kut al Kulub. Yes, Kut al Kulub. So Kut al Kulub and Ghanim, they are living their angsty life for a couple months, maybe about 4 5 months, that they're living this angsty life where they want each other but are not consummating it. And then meanwhile, the caliph has been on a journey and he returns from the journey, and it is Lady Zubaydah. Lady Zubaydah is the one who gave this girl the drug to knock her out and had her buried alive. So not a nice person, this Lady Zubaydah. But Lady Zubaydah is like, well, what are we going to do? The caliph's going to come back and he's going to notice that Kut al Kulub is missing because he loves her. And so she goes to an old lady, and an old lady says, listen, this is what you do. You pretend that Kut al Kulub has died and that we are all in mourning for her. So you have everybody dressed in black, and you get a carpenter to create a like a mannequin basically of Kut al Kulub, and you wrap that in the burial cloths and you get a coffin and you bury her, so that even if he exhumes the body, it looks like there's a body. And then of course he cannot unwrap it because that would be like a sin against God and her and everybody, you know. So they do that, and this plan seems to work. For a month, the caliph sits beside her grave every day and is mourning her. And then one day he goes into his harem and he is resting there. And a couple of the girls in the harem think that he is asleep. And so naturally they start talking about him as he's there, and they say, can you believe this caliph? He is every day mourning for this girl, and I heard she's not even dead. I heard she's been spotted in the city and that she's living with this guy, Ghanim. Well, of course, the caliph overhears this whole thing. And so then, once the girls leave, he springs up and he is in a rage. He orders his army, he gets Jafar in there, and he says, Jafar, go to this guy's house and arrest him and bring back Kut al Kulub to me. Well, they go, and as they're coming, Kut al Kulub is a quick thinker. She sees that they are coming, and she quickly dresses Ghanim in rags. Gives them the trash and says, you pretend you're just the servant taking out the trash and you get out of here before the soldiers can stop you. So he does that. The soldiers come in and they find her and they plunder the house. She says that Ghanim went back home. He's back home in Damascus and she hasn't seen him. So the caliph sends a message to the sultan in Damascus to get Ghanim. And meanwhile, she comes back to the palace. Well, the caliph is mad, and so he puts her in a dark room. She's in the dungeon, basically. So that's where she's going to be for a little while. Meanwhile, the sultan in the other city, Damascus, attacks Ghanim's house. No one is there except for his mother and his sister. But they plunder the house anyway. So now his mother and his sister are in poverty, and Karim himself is both in poverty and he's out of his wits because he has lost this girl that he is in love with and infatuated with. And he has no place to go. So all three of them are wandering beggars, and they all three happen to end up in the same mosque where they are begging. And they are also kind of emaciated and out of their wits at this point that they don't recognize each other. But Ghanim is kind to them in the sense that he is so brokenhearted that he actually, even when people give him food, he doesn't want to eat it. And he keeps passing it to his mother and his sister, not knowing who they are. He gets so bad, he is as thin as a toothpick, that they are going to send him back to Baghdad. Apparently, there's a hospital in Baghdad. And so they tie him to a camel. And his mother and his sisters, they're looking at him and they think, you know, he looks a little bit like Ghanim. Maybe it's him, but we're not sure. But we do know that he's been at least kind to us, so we will travel with him to the hospital. When they get to Baghdad, he is left on the steps of the hospital, and a merchant, not just a merchant, but the superintendent of the merchants finds him, and he knows that doing good deeds will get him rewards in heaven, and so he takes him into his own home instead of into the hospital, and he has his wife start caring for Ghanim. Meanwhile, Kut al-Kulub is crying in the dungeon. And she is crying out about how unjust the caliph is being because someone has done justice to him, protected his own property, but meanwhile, the caliph has plundered this person's property. Well, obviously, this is upsetting to the caliph. He's the justice guy, as we've been discussing in this episode. So he pulls her out of the dungeon, asks what she's talking about. She explains the whole story to him and says, Ghanim was completely upright and never, like, he just protected me. He saved my life. And now you've destroyed him and put him into poverty. And he's a wanted man. He's a felon, basically. And he says, okay, I'll give you anything you want. She says, I want to marry him. And he says, well, if you can find him, then you can marry him. So she goes out and she starts going to the market every day, and she is giving alms to the beggars because she is looking for Ghanim. And in the process of doing that, she meets Ghanim's mother and his sister, although she does not know that that's who they are. And she also meets the superintendent. And the superintendent lets her know, like, hey, you're doing all these good for these beggars and stuff. I have one living in my house. They go to the house. At first, she doesn't recognize him because he's so emaciated. But then the next time that they're there, she's there with the mother and the sister. The mother and the sister say her name, Kut al-Kulub, and he hears that. His spirit returns to his body. He's been so out of his mind with love that his spirit isn't even with his body, but his spirit returns to his body, and he says, "It's me, it's Ghanim." And so then they get all of them all cleaned up and ready to present themselves to the caliph. It takes a few days and a lot of chicken soup, but they do it. They get chicken soup, they get baths, and then they're ready. They go to the caliph. Caliph needs to interview Ghanim, and Ghanim tells them the whole story, start to finish. It lines up with the story that Kut al-Kulub told him. He believes the story. He rewards him with a palace and an honorable robe and allowances, and he's going to let him marry Kut al-Kulub. And in addition, the caliph, on seeing Ghanim's sister, falls in love with her and asks for her hand in marriage. And Ghanim agrees to that, and he gets a gigantic dowry of 100,000 dinars, or whatever these coins are called. And so it's just
Dinars, I
it's a
think.
dinars, and it is a super happy ending with a double wedding, not a single wedding, a double wedding of the caliph and Ghanim's sister and Ghanim and Kut al-Kulub. And this is actually the one with the explicit moral, Michael. I thought it was your story, but it is actually mine. And it says right there at the end, it says, oh, sorry, I'm on the wrong page. Give
I've got it.
me just a
So
second.
that future
You got it?
generations might read it, wonder at the turns of fortune, and entrust their affairs to God, the creator of night and day.
Thank you. Yes. That's so good. That's so good. Like, that's like every fairy tale is that way, right? Like the trust your affairs to God. But this one, it's like so explicit. I loved it. I loved that explicitness in the ending.
And it's the caliph, it's Harun al-Rashid, who kind of makes sure we get the moral, right? Because he's the one who wants this story written down.
So, anything in there that maybe I skipped or maybe I said and you wanted to talk about?
It's interesting, the story makes such a big deal about him being the slave of love. Because this is it is not, when you hear that the title is Ghanim ibn Ayyub, the slave of love, this is not what I pictured would happen. I imagine he would pass from woman to woman, just unable to control his desires. But in fact, he is in love with a slave, basically. But he actually is able to control himself and behaves fairly honorably throughout the story.
Yeah, we talked on the show in the past, and it's been a long time, but about living in a world where there are proper hierarchies and understanding the hierarchy. And he is Ghanim is definitely living in that world, you know? Like he says, like once he finds out that she belongs to the caliph, it's like hands off. And I mean, he even says like a dog cannot sit where a lion is meant to stay or something like that,
right?
You know, like he realizes that positionally between him and the caliph, like this is a no-go zone. And I found that really refreshing, in the same way that I found it refreshing when we were reading Grimm's fairy tales, like understanding that like hierarchy of things, just because it's so different than our current milieu, you know.
Oh yeah. If they were writing a fairy tale now about somebody falling in love with the president's mistress, I mean, really, that's what we're talking about, right? It's not
yes,
it's not the caliph's wife; it's one of his concubines. I mean, you would definitely, there would be no sense that you should back off because of who else she's involved with. Maybe if it was a mob boss or something, but then the mob boss will be a bad guy, and the caliph is not a bad guy in this.
No, he's an upstanding, very good guy.
Yeah, as good as you can get when you have a harem of sex slaves. Again, you just have to accept the world of the story rather than trying to analyze the morality of it from outside of the story itself.
Right. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
This is one of the most horrific things we've read, right? In terms of digging up a chest and there's a drugged woman inside of it.
Yeah, we had a similar, we took a chest up out of the depths of the river, but the woman in there was already dead.
Yeah, the fisherman and the genie, I think was the name of that one.
Yeah. Excuse me. But yeah, that's, yeah. It's not a pretty sight. Although I guess it was a pretty sight for Gunny. He immediately fell in love, so.
As one does. I mean, maybe that's the sense in which he's the slave of love. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I felt it was maybe just in the sense of like he gives up on life. Like, I mean, yes, he's lost all of his possessions, but the idea I got in the story was it's not just that he's lost his wealth and his position; it's that he's lost her. Is the real reason why he kind of gives up on living?
I guess that really makes it a parallel emaciated. With the last story with Nur al-Din. Right. Ask one who's still alive.
Right. Yeah. Because Nur al-Din's going to be, he's living the path that Nur al-Din could have taken if, you know, at that point in the story, if the same caliph, funny enough, had just been like, oh yeah, I'll just take her and goodbye, you know, then yeah, that would have, this is kind of the alternate universe version of that.
Yeah, Al-Rashid seems to just float through Baghdad, solving everybody's problems.
Yeah, and locking girls in rooms. Interminably.
I'm just looking to see what my notes are here about this one. I have far fewer because I liked the other one much more, although I liked this one as well. And they do make really good companion stories because they have a very similar structure. And like I said at the beginning of the episode, you really do see that U catastrophe where everything is about to go wrong and all of a sudden it goes right. And you can say that's Allah, or you can say it's Harun al-Rashid. And maybe that's just to say that Harun al-Rashid is the messenger of Allah, that he is doing his job as a caliph, which is to make sure that the will of God is enacted on earth.
Yeah. As far as the will of God thing, yeah, there is that, like, so this story doesn't come together without, like, the merchant, the superintendent of the merchants being also a really good guy and, like, looking out for the beggars that are coming to his marketplace, which I thought was interesting. And it is very explicit in the text, like, he's doing this for heavenly rewards. So there's definitely like, I don't know, that system of thought or belief about the things that we do on earth will receive a heavenly reward, and that's why we should do it. It's like that said, like the story doesn't work if he's not doing those things, you know. He can't partner with Kut al-Kulub to help her find her lost husband if he's not familiar with the beggars. So I thought that was really, he's another person who's in a position of authority or power, but is like looking out for the least of these.
And Harun al-Rashid has to be reminded to do that, right? Because he overhears Kutah Kalub saying that one day he and Ghanim are going to stand before God, and Ghanim is going to demand justice, and this is enough to make al-Rashid do the right thing.
I didn't have anything else really to say on that story, though.
I do think it's interesting. You always have to keep the frame story in mind that this is Scheherazade talking to this fabulously unjust king. And maybe the reason Harun al-Rashid appears in so many of these is that Scheherazade is trying to remind him of what he should be.
Right. Yeah, I think that framing story, yeah, you mentioned that in our last episode too, and I had not been thinking about it, but then since you mentioned it, I was definitely thinking about it this time. And I think that is a very she's trying to tell these stories to stay alive, and so there's always the kind of like cliffhanger at each night, she like lets off right when the story is if the story starts to dip at all, like that's never when she lets off, like she always brings something else in, and then it's like, oh, that's the end of the night.
You got to keep them wanting more.
So there is that aspect to it, but you're right. Then within that, there's also these morals to the story, and because the king that she is telling these stories to is a really bad dude.
Yeah, outrageously bad. Well,
Oh, I you know what the other thing I was going to say, I don't remember if it was in my story or yours. There was a thing in here about necessity. I think it was in your story, but it kind of works for both of them. Just a little like poem, four lines of poem that I feel like is another like thing. It's in your story, but I feel like it works across both these stories where it says, necessity forces men in their affairs to follow paths that do not fit good manners. When someone brings himself to do something, the reason for it matches what he does. I felt like that was kind of also another key that connects both these stories. Like they're both like you can judge a person and the way they act from their actions, but many times there is something behind it that's driving that. That's like in this case, some sort of necessity or need. A lot of these stories, I feel like there's that like the clothes make the man, like when you're dressed like a fine merchant, or you're dressed like a caliph, or you're dressed like a poor fisherman, like people treat you that way. But underneath those things, like when he is dressed as a beggar, there's like they keep saying in the story, like, oh, but it seems like he had a fine life before, like it seems like maybe he used to be prosperous. And there's like this, I don't know, like there's a veil of poverty, and maybe there's also like this veil of pious or impious living where underneath it there's always like a necessity or a need that's driving that.
Yeah, and I think it's just part of the complexity of the stories as well, that there's always another layer of narrative underneath, and probably there's more narrative that we don't have access to that's nevertheless controlling these stories as well. Well, our next story, Josh, is as long as everything we've read up to this point. The next story, let me look at the name of it. It's King somebody, King Umar ibn al-Numan and his family. And it goes from page 304 to page 613. It's actually longer than everything we've read so far. And there's not even another story embedded in it until page 475. So I think the least we could read for the next episode would be 171 pages. Which is a lot.
Okay.
We're talking about 62 nights before the next one. So here's what I'm going to suggest. I'm going to suggest we do that. We go, we read Nights 45 through 107, but we do the next Arabian Nights episode 2 months from now. And next month we talk about Zootopia 2. And that way we'll have a little bit more time to read this very long reading.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good. I have, I don't know if you've started or not. I've started it and it is really good.
Is it good? I hope so. Cause a 300 page story, I mean, mini novels are not 300 pages.
Right. But it reads like a novel. Like, well, I shouldn't say quite like a novel. It's still definitely, you know, an older style, like a pre-novel style of writing. But the story's pretty good. So, I think that sounds good. So next month, Zootopia 2. And following that up through Nights 107, if anybody is reading along.
Yeah, I don't know if people read along or not, or if they require us to give the plot summary. But we'll do the first half of this novella in 2 months, and next month we'll talk about Zootopia 2. Our listeners who don't already listen to it, Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, Revisionist History, just did a two-part series on Zootopia 2 that I think both of us found very interesting. So anybody who hasn't listened to that, Mike, I still haven't seen the movie, so maybe I should have watched it before I listened to that, because now I'm going to have ideas about it going in. But I did find that to be the question is whether Zootopia was a stolen property, and they give a description in the first one of those Malcolm Gladwell episodes about what the movie was supposedly originally going to look like. And it sounded like a much better movie. They said that the guy who originally invented it, it had that same idea that you could be whatever you want, except it was making fun of that idea, which would have been such a better movie than what we actually got.
Can you imagine a movie executed at the level that Zootopia want? Sorry, we don't need to have a mini Disney podcast at the end of our other podcast, but so we can get into it next time. But just imagine a world where a movie executed at the level that Zootopia was executed at, because it was executed at a very high level, but with an actually strong moral message instead of probably, arguably, one of the worst messages that Disney has ever produced.
Yeah, it would have been great. But anyway, I do recommend that Revisionist History series.
As do I. It was very interesting. So, well, with that, our press liaison is Christian Filipic, and we are on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org, and you can help us continue this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. You can also check out Michael's weekly podcast called A Symposium of Popular Song. That's at Front Porch Republic. And we also want to encourage you to set your podcast player's dials to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, where you will find an abundance of old shows and some occasional new shows to keep you going. Michael and I know there are a great number of podcasts out there you could be spending them on, so thank you for spending the time with us. So for Michael Farmer, I'm Joshua Altmanschofer, reminding you, as the poet says, find me a man whose meanness won him fame, or one who died of generosity.